Trinity Baptist Church.
When Joshua had grown old, the Lord said to him, "You're now very old, and there are still very large areas of land to be taken over. This is the land that remains. All the regions of the Philistines and Geshurites, from the Shahor River on the east of Egypt to the territory of Ekron on the north, all of it counted as Canaanite, though held by the five Philistine rulers in Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. The territory of the Avites on the south, all the land of the Canaanites, from Arah of the Sidonians as far as Aphek and the border of the Amorites, the area of Byblos, and all Lebanon to the east, from Baal-Gad below Mount Hermon to Lebo Hamath. As for the inhabitants of the mountain regions, from Lebanon to Misrephoth-Maim, that is all the Sidonians, I myself will drive them out before the Israelites. Be sure to allocate this land to Israel for inheritance as I have instructed you, and divide it as an inheritance among the nine tribes and half of the tribe of Manasseh." The word of the Lord.
How many of you feel like you're getting old? I have always considered myself to be a young man, but there are a few things happening in my life and around my life that are betraying that notion. For instance, if you're sitting in the balcony today, you know that I have a bald spot. Ben and Claire are going to college this next year. And that shouldn't make me feel old. It should actually make Keith feel old. But it does make me feel old for some reason. But he's got nothing on me, because my daughter is 7 months old, which means I will be 62 when she graduates from high school. The upside is that I can use my Social Security to pay for her college. A few weeks ago, Beth asked me to help out with a responsive reading, and when I got up here, I realized I couldn't read the screen in the back. So things are happening around me. Life is happening. We're all getting a little older. And speaking of getting older, I heard this story recently that is about a 90-year-old man by the name of Wilbur. And Wilbur is married, to a woman by the name of Dora. And Wilbur and Dora were sitting in their living room watching TV when Dora said to Wilbur, "Wilbur, why don't you ever sit close to me like you used to?" And so Wilbur moved over and sat right next to Dora. And a few minutes later, Dora said, "Wilbur, why don't you ever put your arm around me like you used to?" And so Wilbur put his arm around Dora and held her tightly. And then Dora said, "Wilbur, why don't you ever nibble my ear like you used to?" And then Wilbur immediately got up and walked out of the room. And Dora said, "Wilbur, where are you going?" And Wilbur said, "I'm going to get my teeth." We're all getting older. For the past 4 months or so, we have been in this series through the book of Joshua. And if you've been with us, you know that this book is about taking new ground in our lives spiritually, but also taking new ground physically. And today, we are in chapter 13, where we learn that Joshua is old. His exact age, we do not know. It's never given. But most commentators would suggest that at this point in his life, he's between 80 and 90 years old. And there are parts of Canaan that are yet to be taken. So God essentially says to Joshua, Joshua, you're not getting any younger. And there's a lot of land to be taken. So essentially, get out there and do it. Okay? Now, a famous commentator by the name of Matthew Henry says that it's really good for us to be reminded of our age, especially if we're old, to be reminded of the brevity of life so that we will quickly do what we must do before time runs out. And we all have things to do. We all have things that are left undone regardless of how old we are. Now, God had promised that he would give all of Israel, or all of Canaan to Israel, all of Canaan, and that would be divided among the tribes, and that would be their inheritance. But there is still a lot of land to be taken. Okay, now for the past 7 years, the Israelites have been knocking off one city at a time. And most of the larger cities had been taken by now. But there were still a number of residual cities that were left to be taken. And to get rid of them would be both difficult and time-consuming. Now, after 40 years in the desert and 7 years on this military campaign, it's quite possible that Joshua was getting tired. Tired of the battle, tired of the continuous fighting. Maybe he felt like he had done his part. Maybe he wanted a little peace and quiet. Maybe he felt like it was good enough. But God did not want Joshua to settle. He didn't want him to stop short of fulfilling the call that he had put on his life and receiving the inheritance that was his and Israel's. So God commanded Joshua to conquer the land that had been left unsubdued and to proceed with the division of the land, as was planned. Now, in every facet of our lives, we want to live. But we don't just want to live, we want to live well. And we don't just want to live well, we want to finish well, right? We want to finish well. We want to fulfill the calling that God has placed on our lives. And while this sounds simple enough, many of us miss it. Now, why do we miss it? How do we miss it? Well, frequently we start out strong. We get this vision from God and we start moving in that direction. But over time, we get tired. Life happens. Circumstances come up. And we become complacent or overwhelmed. And many of us decide at some point or another to give up or to give in. We get caught up in the demands of everyday life and we lose sight of the bigger picture. Right? We've all been there. We lack the discernment that we need to fully embrace what it is that God has for us. And then we become discouraged. Now, after a few sessions like this, or seasons, we start asking questions like this. Is there really an abundant life? And if there is an abundant life, is it attainable? Is it really attainable? Can it be achieved? Where do I find peace? And what is my place in God's story? What is my place in God's story? Now, in the book of James, chapter 1, verses 12, it says, "Blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God has promised to those who love him." What is James saying here? What is he trying to say? He's saying, don't give up. Don't give up when it gets tough, because the greatest reward comes to those who finish well. The greatest reward comes to those who finish well. So when it gets tough, don't give up. Don't throw in the towel. Now, a lot of times we feel called to something particular, but we get discouraged, as I said. I heard a story about a young woman who felt called to be a kindergarten teacher. Nothing energized her more than investing in the lives of young children. But sometimes her job was difficult and discouraging. There was a lot more administrative work than she anticipated. There were forms that needed to be filled out, teacher evaluations, and sometimes the kids were just downright unruly. It was hard. It was difficult, and sometimes she thought about quitting. One day, a young boy from her class came to her and asked her for help with putting his cowboy boots on. And it didn't take long for her to see why. Even with her pulling and him pushing, the little boots didn't want to go on. Finally, after several minutes of struggling with these boots, she got them on. And so she almost cried when the little boy looked down and said, "Teacher, they're on the wrong feet." So she looked down, and sure enough, they were on the wrong feet. And it wasn't any easier pulling those boots off than it was getting them on. But she kept her cool, and she got the boots back on the right feet. And just then, the boy said, "These aren't my boots." Now, she bit her tongue and asked, "Why didn't you tell me they weren't your boots?" And again, she struggled to help him put the ill-fitting boots back on his little feet. But no sooner had the boots been taken off his feet and put back on, he says, "My mom told me that I should wear these boots because they're actually my brother's." And so she had just taken these boots off, but now she finds that they're her brother's, so she has to put them back on again. Stifling a scream, she musters the grace and courage to wrestle the ill-footing boots back on for a third time. And now with the boots firmly on, she thinks, "You know what? Now I think what I'll do is help him with his coat." So she gets the arms in, gets the coat buttoned up. She puts his hat on, and then she says to him, "Now where are your mittens?" And he said, "Well, I stuffed them into the toes of my boots." You see, when God puts a calling on our lives, he doesn't tell us that it's necessarily going to be easy, right? He doesn't say it's going to be easy. And we should never assume that when things get difficult in our lives that God is no longer in it. Because he is in it. In fact, if you think about it, if you think about the more challenging seasons of your life, usually that's where God really shows up. Isn't it true? He frequently shows up in those seasons where life is difficult. But having said that, have you noticed that there are certain people that seem to have the ability to navigate difficulties with ease? They seem to transcend the challenges that come with life. They're able to rise to the occasion and find success in all they do. And Joshua was a person like this. If you look at Joshua's life, it's just an outstanding representation of success. Now, as I was thinking about the successes in Joshua's life, I started wondering if there are certain things about all successful people that we could embrace that would enable us to navigate challenges in our life and really fulfill the calling that God has placed on our lives. And as I was thinking about that, I was reminded of a book that I read a few years ago by Henry Cloud called 9 Things You Simply Must Do to Succeed in Love and Life. Great book. And it totally reminded me of that question that I was asking. Are there certain principles, are there certain things that we could adopt that would enable us to be successful, to overcome adversity? And what I found interesting is a lot of the principles that were in this book, Joshua applied in his life. And I think we can too. Now, when Henry wrote this book, he wrote it after he had had a number of encounters with various people. And in each encounter, he had this sort of deja vu experience where he felt like somehow I must have met this person before. But then he realized, well, that couldn't possibly be the case because these were business deals with people that he'd never met before, and he knew he hadn't met them before. And then he realized it wasn't the people, but it was something that these people were doing Something that these people were doing that resonated. There was a kind of person who could face and resolve situations in the same way that would ensure their success. When they got stuck, they became unstuck very quickly. When they made mistakes, they didn't make the same mistakes over and over again. And they were all able to reach their goals and find success in life. All of them in very different spheres of life, but all of them successful. Now, the other thing that he noticed about these people was that their success was not limited to vague notions of charisma or traditional advantages such as graduate degrees or networks. But what they had in common was this distinct set of principles that they all lived by. And so Henry put these principles together in this book, and he came up with 9 principles. And I won't be able to cover all of them today, but I wanted to look at a few of them in light of Joshua's experience and our experience in life. Now, the first principle is entitled, dig it up. Dig it up. Now, what does that mean? Well, Henry said that for successful people, the invisible world is where life really is. And this is how he defines success here, and I'll read this twice so you get it. He says, success can be defined as a process of digging up the treasures of the invisible soul in order to bring dreams, desires, and talents into the visible world. Okay? You get that? Success can be defined as the process of digging up the treasures of the invisible soul in order to bring dreams, desires, and talents into the visible world. Okay. Now, for instance, think about this sanctuary. Look around for a moment. What do you see? This is an amazing sanctuary. And, you know, we come in here all the time, and a lot of times we just don't think much about it. But do you know that there's imagery hidden all throughout this place, all around the frescoes and, you know, the angels. And if you look up, you'll see the eye of God looking down at you. And just the substance of this building as well, the pillars and the stained glass windows that each tell a different story that draw us in to a relationship with God. And it's functional. I mean, it really serves us perfectly for what we're trying to accomplish here. And regardless of what the weather is like outside, it's great in here. It's just a tremendous facility. But where did it originate? Where did it come from? You might say, well, a builder or a contractor, maybe an architect. And that's true. But take it back a little bit further than that. Where did it really originate? You see, Henry describes this as something that came from the imagination, the invisible world of a toddler. In this case, a little boy in Sweden, probably around 2 years old, playing with some blocks, and he's stacking them on top of one another, and something miraculous takes place as he's stacking these blocks. He taps into one of the two most powerful forces in the universe, talent and desire. When he's playing with these blocks, something comes alive in him. And he knows there's something special about this, even at that age. So later, as he continues to pursue this passion, he develops other skills in mathematics and in drawing, and later he becomes an architect, and he becomes a successful architect, and this building is the culmination of that seed that was planted in his soul all those years before. The physical reality of this building, the real structure in the visible world, came from the invisible reality of this little boy's talent. It came from his soul. And if you think about it, God designed each of us with gifts and passions And as we identify and develop our gifts and passions, we are positioned for incredible success. We're positioned to fulfill the calling that God has placed on our lives. So what is it that enables you to feel God's pleasure? If you think about it, listen to your heart. What makes it sing? What lies deep inside is where real life is. We just need to spend more time listening to it, looking for it. We need to dig it up. So there's the first principle. Successful people, dig it up. Okay, now a second principle that Henry identified in successful people was their willingness to yank the diseased tooth. What does that mean? Yank the diseased tooth. What he means is that successful people get rid of the bad stuff in their lives. Now, sometimes they do it quickly, and sometimes it's more of a process. But they get rid of it. They all get rid of the bad stuff. They don't allow negative things to drain them of the energy and the resources they need. And if the tooth is infected, they pull it out. Okay? Now, we know that Joshua was commanded by God to completely wipe out the Canaanites because they were an infected tooth, so to speak. Now, as Keith mentioned last week, that sounds pretty harsh. How could a loving God will that an entire nation be wiped out completely? And I know a number of people struggle with this. But before we jump to some conclusions, let's consider just a few things here. Let's dig a little deeper. First, this was a very unique historical situation. And remember, God had given the Canaanites 400 years to repent. 400 years. And what's interesting is during this 400 years, God's people, the Israelites, were held in captivity. They were slaves while God was waiting for the Canaanites to soften their hearts and repent. But they wouldn't do it. Now, another thing that's really important for you to know is really this was not so much about the Canaanite people as it was about the Canaanite religion. You see, I'm not sure if you know about this, but Canaanite gods and goddesses participated in all sorts of sexual acts, including incest and bestiality. And the worshipers, the Canaanite people that worshipped these gods and goddesses, these deities, engaged in ritual prostitution, infant sacrifice, and other deviant acts. So you can imagine how God felt about some of that stuff. Now, God knew that these behaviors and this religion that was taking place, these destroying acts, had to stop. They had to be obliterated. And wiping them out was God's way of saying, enough. Enough. Now, second, by wiping out the Canaanites, this enabled God to prepare a land for his people and the proper religious setting to make sense of a coming Messiah. Now, the interesting thing about this Messiah is this Messiah would not just come for the Israelites, but he would come for the Gentiles as well. So God was opening the doors for everyone to receive salvation. So killing the Canaanites wasn't racially motivated. It was theologically and morally motivated. And had Joshua refused to pull out this infected tooth and to drive the remaining inhabitants from the land, what would have happened was the Israelites would have intermarried and they would have become increasingly tolerant of these other religious practices and customs. And little by little, they would have lost sight of God. And ultimately, they would have turned their backs on God and been lost forever. And God wasn't going to have that. He wasn't going to allow that to happen. So let me ask you, what are the things in your life that are dragging you down? What's the infected tooth in your life, and what are you doing about it? Are you taking steps to get rid of it? Now, a third principle that Henry identified was that successful people have the ability to play the whole movie. To play the whole movie. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, let me explain it through an illustration. There was an old man sitting on a park bench. And he was a man of ritual, and he would go to this park bench and sit there every day with a newspaper. It was just what he did. And he would enjoy the sights and the sounds and the people walking by and the birds. And one day, as he was sitting on this bench, a young man walked up, and he had a newspaper as well. And he sat down right next to the older man. So the older man moved over to give him a little bit of space. And as he was moving over, he looked over at this young man, and he noticed, you know, the paper that he had chosen. And he noticed that, you know, he was a clean-cut young man, and that he seemed like a nice young man. That was his observation. And then he continued to read his paper. And the young man was reading his paper as well. And a few minutes passed, and then the young man turned to the older man and said, "Excuse me, sir, could you give me the time?" And again, the older man looked over at the young man and thought, you know, he's very clean cut. Seems like he has great manners. Seems like a really good young man. And he said, "No." And then he continued reading his paper. Well, the young man was kind of perplexed by this because he noticed that the old man had a watch on. So he thought, why would he not tell me the time? So he waited a minute and then he said, "Excuse me, sir, you know, I couldn't help but notice, but you had a watch. And when I asked you for the time, you said no. And I wondered if I had offended you in any way." And the older man said, no, you didn't. And then he continued to read his paper. And so this young man was like, excuse me again, sir, I don't mean to be a pest, but I really need to know, why would you not want to tell me the time? And the older man said, "Okay, let me put it to you like this. You see, when you came over here and you sat down, I noticed the newspaper that you had chosen. And I know it's a great newspaper, and so you're very interested in world history and political things, and I admired that. I was impressed. Secondly, you're very clean cut. You seem very personable. You seem like a very good young man. And I know that if I were to give you the time, we would probably strike up a conversation. And if we were to strike up a conversation, we would probably over time become friends. And then if I came back to this bench, you would probably come back to this bench. And then over time, I would feel inclined to invite you over to my house. And if I invited you to my house, you would meet my beautiful daughter, who I love very much. And if you met my beautiful daughter, she would see that you're a nice-looking young man with a great personality, and there's a good chance that she would like you. And if she liked you and you liked her, you would probably ask her on a date. And if you went on a date, things could progress, and you might ask her to marry you. And I'll be damned if I would let a young man who doesn't have a watch marry my daughter." Now, what Henry was trying to show us in this diatribe is that this man was playing the movie forward. And what he was saying is all people who are successful learn how to play the movie forward. You see, successful people evaluate just about every decision they make, everything that they do. They see every decision as a link in a larger chain, steps in a direction that has an ultimate destination. Okay? In short, they rarely do anything without thinking through the ultimate consequences of the things that they're doing. They live their lives as if it were a movie. Now, many of you have been to movies, many, many movies, in fact. And there are times when we go to a movie when about halfway through, you already know how the movie's going to end, right? You can kind of see how the plot is unfolding. And if we were to live our lives that way, we could evaluate our lives as they are now and assess whether or not the movie is going to end well. We could make an assessment. And if it wasn't looking like it was going to end well, we still have time to tweak some things, to make some changes, so that the movie will end well, the way that we desire. Okay? And that's what Henry is saying successful people do. Now, Joshua was a person like this. He was able to see the bigger picture. He was able to play the movie forward. And he was also able to look back at the very beginning of the movie as to how it started. So he could make certain assumptions about how it would end. Do you remember the first time Joshua set his eyes on the promised land? Do you remember what happened? Remember, he was called by Moses to be one of the spies. There were 12 spies. They were sent into the land to scout it out. 10 of the spies came back, and what did they say? They were fearful. They said this would be a suicide mission, essentially. But there were two of the spies that thought differently, Caleb and Joshua. Now, Joshua saw this experience, this opportunity, entirely different, from an entirely different perspective, because Joshua had experienced God's unfailing love and provision and faithfulness. And he was certain that if God was going to be faithful in the past and had been consistently faithful throughout his life, wouldn't it make sense that he would likely be faithful going forward if this is what he was calling us to? And so this is what he said. He said, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If the Lord is pleased with us, he will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and he will give it to us." And do you know, you may remember when Keith preached about this, the Israelites wanted to stone him after he said that. They were so gripped with fear. Joshua didn't have any idea how the victory would come. He understood that the odds were against him. He knew they were outgunned, so to speak. But he could play the movie back and he could play it forward. And in chapter 13, God is challenging Joshua to play the movie forward. He wants him to think about what it would look like if he didn't wipe out the rest of these nations. What if he did stop short of the goal? How would the movie end? See, God doesn't want the movie to end that way. He wants Joshua to finish well. He wants Joshua to receive his inheritance, and he wants Israel to receive their inheritance. Now, there are several additional principles within the book, and I would encourage you to read it or download it on Kindle, whatever you do. It's a great book. I can't cover them all. But I wanted to touch on one principle that wasn't even in the book. And I think the reason why Henry didn't put it in the book was he was marketing to more of a secular market. But there was one principle about Joshua that he embraced, and that I think all people that really want to fulfill the calling that God has placed in their life embrace. And that is the pursuit of intimacy with God. The pursuit of intimacy and how critical that is. Now, Moses knew about this secret, and he found it in the tent of meeting where he spent face-to-face time with God. Now, interestingly, Moses would sometimes invite Joshua, his assistant, to come into the tent of meeting with him. In Exodus 33:11, it says, "The Lord would speak to Moses face to face as one who speaks to a friend. Then Moses would return to the camp. But his young aide, Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent." What does that tell us about Joshua? Joshua recognized that there's really something special about what's happening here in this tent of meeting. Moses had the opportunity to meet with God face to face. And Joshua could see firsthand how Moses' life was being transformed by these interactions with God. And he wanted some. He wanted part of it. Not only did he want part of it, but even after Moses had his fill and went back to the camp, Joshua stayed behind and said, no, this is where I want to be, in the tent of meeting. I want to be face to face with God as well. Long before Joshua became a successful military leader and ultimately the leader of all of Israel, he learned the importance of developing intimacy with God. And I think that made all the difference. I think that set him up for success. It gave him insight and wisdom and direction, discernment, confidence, power. Now, how do we develop that kind of intimacy with God so that we can apply those same principles in our daily lives, here and now, in New York, at our job, in our family, in our wherever? Well, first of all, I think there are a few things. But first of all, I think, number one, we need to make it our utmost priority. It needs to be our number one priority, developing intimacy with God. You see, life is speeding up around us all the time. It's not slowing down, it's speeding up. And intimacy is not something that just happens. If you're in any kind of a relationship, you know that intimacy doesn't just happen. You have to work at it. You have to be intentional about it. And we need to be intentional about our time with God. We need to make appointments to meet with God. And we need to keep those appointments. Right? Okay, by doing so, our bond with God grows stronger and stronger each day. And we become a person of vision, a person of power, a person with discernment and insight and direction. Number two, we need to do it now. We need to do it now. In New York, in particular, we can't wait until things settle down. We can't wait until things settle down because they're not going to. Things are not going to settle down. We can't wait until this busy season is past because it won't pass. There's going to be another busy season right around the corner. And that big project that we're working on, we can't wait till that project is done because there's going to be another project right after it. Okay? Number three, we need to develop our listening skills. When we wait on the Lord, he gives us a strategy. He gives us a sense of confidence so that we can carry out his plan the way he would carry out the plan if he were doing it. Okay? When we listen to God, we become aligned with God. Our thoughts become his thoughts. Our ways become his ways. And the fruit of the Spirit starts to flow from us. Have you ever noticed that when you haven't spent time with God in a while, you start to feel powerless? That sense of the presence of the Spirit is hard to tap into. And yet, if you've been intimate with God, you're re-energized. It's like you get an infilling of the presence and power of God, and it flows through us. And it's something that people can experience around us. But it doesn't come without that kind of intimacy. It doesn't come without that intimacy. Now, all throughout the book of Joshua, when the Israelites waited on God and they listened to his instruction, things went well for them. Exceptionally well. But when they decided to do things in their own strength and they didn't listen to God, it was a disaster. Every time, lives were lost. It was not a good thing. And it was God's way of teaching them to develop this intimacy that he knew they needed. Now, number four, we need to integrate God into everything that we do. God should be a part of everything that we do. You see, God is orchestrating divine appointments for us right now. And those divine appointments are made available to us every day. But we can easily miss them because we're too hurried, or because we're not looking for them, or because we don't have margin. One of the things that I do in the morning is I pray for divine appointments. But you know what? I fall short in this area because sometimes I pray for divine appointments and then I'm actually able to see them but I haven't given myself enough margin to actually respond to them. Have you ever seen an opportunity presented to you to do something really great, but you realized you had 2 minutes to get to a meeting? And so you're like, oh man, I'd really like to make a difference there, but I can't. I got this meeting. We miss divine appointments because we don't create margin in our lives. Someone once told me that all throughout the Bible, we see Jesus walking to various places, but we never see him running. He never ran anywhere because he always knew to create margin. And finally, we need to evaluate everything that we do. We need to evaluate everything we do. We need to continually ask ourselves, is this the best use of my time right now? Does this glorify God? Are my priorities aligned with God in this moment? And are my passions, the skills, the things that God has placed in my life, the talents, the ability, are they being tapped into in this moment? And if they're not, we need to pray about that and realign ourselves with God. Now, as we learn to seek God in this way and develop this kind of intimacy, he will reveal himself to us more and more and more. More and more. And the great adventure that he has for you will become not just an invisible hope or vision, it will become a physical reality. God will help you give birth to whatever it is that he has called you to. And that's where we want to be, right? So what is it that God is calling you to? Are there certain things that have been left undone? For most of us, the answer is yes. You know, maybe we have a sense of what God is calling us to, but there are a number of things that are left undone. And we need to be ticking those off. You see, finishing well doesn't only relate to the end of our lives. Finishing well relates to every endeavor that we take on. Every endeavor. Remember playing the movie forward? We need to finish everything we start well. So let's dig it up. Let's yank the diseased tooth. Let's play the movie forward. And most of all, let's make intimacy our number one priority. Okay? Remember, God is more desirous of that kind of intimacy with us than we are desirous of it. And we're the ones that really benefit. But we've got to make it a priority. Let's pray. Lord, I do thank you so much for your willingness to invest in us. Sometimes I don't understand why you would feel the desire to do that. We're so wishy-washy and so prone to distraction or failure. But your desire is to never give up on us. And we love you for that, Lord. Help us to develop intimacy with you.